When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to the Billboard Chartbeat Podcast. Gary Truss, Billboard's co-director of charts.
And hey guys, Trevor Anderson, chart manager here at Billboard.
In Billboard's New York offices. And this is where we look at why what's on the charts is on the charts. So lots to get to this week. Sam Smith is back. A big debut on the Hot 100 this week at number 5 with Too Good at Goodbyes. It's the first single from his second album. And actually got to see Sam in concert last week here in New York. So I got some details about how the show went. And we'll look at a few acts like Sam that recently had a huge debut albums, and then how they fared the second time out. Get a gauge of what might be next for Sam if he's hopefully going to keep continuing whole run of hits. So we'll look at that. Plus, this week, a great industry insider interview. We're going back to Nashville for our latest artist and record executive shared interview. This time, Billboard senior chart manager Jim Asker chats with Ray Lynn, who recently debuted at number 1 on the Top Country Albums chart, along with chairman and CEO of Warner Music Nashville, John Esposito. So just like we've had recent interviews with Jim, with Luke Bryan, Maren Morris, and their respective label executives. This is another good one, and we get into a little bit, too, of the lack of women at country on the country charts in recent times, so they both have opinions about that. So that's coming up as the main interview this week here on the podcast. But before we go, we'll also flash back to when, Trevor? I'll let you talk now.
Whew! And we'll take a trip back to 1972. In particular, due to some current events that will be happening. So we're going to tie a little bit of history into something that I'm sure many people have seen on the news, on their social media feeds, a particular phrase that's going around, also the name of a very, very popular song from back in the day. So we'll revisit that chart trajectory and take a look at that.
Trajectory, I think that's a clue.
That it helps. It does help, yeah.
Let's look at this week's Top 10 on the Billboard Hot 100.
10, 9, 8. 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Number 10. Number 5. number four. Quiero desnudarte a besos despacito. Firmo en las paredes de tu laberinto. Y hacer de tu cuerpo todo un manuscrito. Number three. Number two.
I don't dance now, I make money move. Say I don't gotta dance, I make money move. If I see you now speak, that means I don't fuck with you. I'm a boss who a work a bitch.
And number one.
Look what you made me do. Look what you just made me do. Look what you just made me do. Look what you made me do. Look what you made me do. Look what you just made me do. Look what you just made me do. I don't trust nobody.
And bringing us out number one once again for a third week, we got Taylor Swift's Look What You Made Me Do. Right behind her, Cardi B once again holding strong in the runner-up spot with Bodak Yellow, Money Moves. So the song, and a lot of people have been watching this kind of hoping it would go to number one. A lot of social media fans out there. Number two for right now, knocking on the door. We can talk a little bit in a few minutes about what the projections for next week could look like. Also, heating up in the race, you've got the Ascendants of Logic at number three with 1-800-273-8255, which features Alessia Cara and Khalid. So, which is really, as we've talked a couple times on the podcast, blown up in particular after the VMA's performance right at the end of August. So that song making nice gains, and also, you know, just two spots from the top spot. So pretty interesting race heating up in post-Despacito world.
Right. If you look at the numbers, Taylor Swift's Look What You Made Me Do is down 31% in overall points this week. Bodak Yellow is down, too. It's down 11%. So it closes the gap, but they're both down. And Logic song is up 3%. So that's the one that's gaining of the three of them. So, yeah, next week we could have maybe a tighter race among the three of them. Although, actually, maybe there's another song that we need to be thinking about for next week.
Yeah, and this particular song, I think, came out of nowhere. It seems like a dark horse instantly for potentially, you know, a top 10, maybe as far as number one quickly. We're talking about the Post Malone 21 Savage collaboration Rockstar, which just came out last Friday, September 15th. The song, instantly big reception. It's been number one on iTunes all the way since that Friday into this recording on Tuesday. Also holding strong, I think, every day since as well, at number one on the U.S. Spotify, pulling around 2 million streams a day.
Right.
The Logic song in second place on that count with about 1.3, so it just kind of shows you the gap there as well. And, I mean, for two people who are hit makers, you know, Post Malone's been in the top 10 of the Hot 100 with Congratulations just this past year, 21 Savage. But for two guys who aren't sort of superstars to have this kind of instant reception, that's interesting, you know?
What do you think of the song?
I like it. I mean, I do. I think it's really catchy. I think it's. I mean, it's got this, the it's almost like I can't even describe, like, the word of the element that I think that works so well for it. Like, trap, I think, is such an overused word at this point. Like, everything's kind of trappy, you know, Bodak Yellow's trappy, this is all trappy. But there's something kind of song you could just, like, put on.
Right.
Like, you know, it's low-key enough, feels good, not, you know, it just has that same kind of sound that Migos and so many other acts have really captured this year. But yeah, we'll be sure to watch for that one.
Yeah, we're still getting actually numbers, projections of what it could sell, what it could stream, so we'll have a little bit better idea. But yeah, Monday, we'll find out where it debuts.
But flipping back to this week, we'll talk about the big debut happening right now. We've got Sam Smith at number five, debuting with Too Good at Goodbyes, as Gary mentioned earlier, the first single from Sam's second album,
right,
which I think people may also kind of forget that, you know, Sam Smith has been gone in some ways longer than Taylor Swift. It feels like, I mean, that was 2014 when Stay With Me blew up and kind of carried through to the end of the fall. And, you know, he had the Grammys and the song from James Bond the next year. But in terms of an album, I mean, it's been quite a while between these two Sam Smith albums.
And a little different from Taylor because she was so established at this point. It's Sam Smith's debut album. So to go that long between the first and second album, yeah, you kind of risk. Maybe a new audience comes in and they don't quite know who he is. But so I went to the show. I saw him. He played at Mercury Lounge last week. From the beginning, you could tell people had not forgotten about Sam Smith. It was really cool. He came out started doing Lay Me Down on the very first line of the song, people were singing along so fully and so loudly. And I think just by his reaction, he was kind of surprised by that in a really humble, genuine way. I don't think he expected everyone to be singing with him right from the start. So I think he really hit him that he was really happy that, people were with him still after this delay.
Yeah, I mean, I can imagine that, especially in that intense crowd. I think it's one thing that you mentioned is a Mercury Lounge, which is one of the first venues he played, you know, right, in New York. And I think that's something that I think is so cool in particular, and these that you've seen in the past couple of years, is a lot of artists particularly returning to those venues. Ed Sheeran had a show. It may have been, maybe it was Mercury, wherever he first played when he came stateside, you know, the same kind of environment, you know, just a couple hundred fans. I mean, Alicia Keys has done it in the past, plenty of artists have, but I think it's great, you know, that they remember where they came from, because they can, of course, they can always play the arenas and the stadiums, but you can tell that they acknowledge and appreciate the intimacy of just a solid, you know, just solid crowd and singer connection.
Yeah, and for people who don't necessarily know that venue or other venues in that area in the city, you walk through, there's different venues like this. They all have kind of a similar setup. You literally walk through a bar to get to where the show is. So it's, you don't feel like you're at a huge arena. It feels so intimate that you just kind of, oh, there's a singer. It just happens to be in the corner. It's a little bigger than that, but it really feels intimate just from the moment you walk in that way.
So you're at the show. He plays, obviously, Lay Me Down, some of the songs from the first album.
Right.
I'm sure he played the new single as well. Did he play anything else? Did he give any taste of the new album?
He did. He did, I think four songs. There were new ones, and hard to tell the titles just from hearing them live. But another ballad called Midnight Train, which seemed to be called Midnight Train.
Not the cover of Gladys. Nope. That we're all hoping for.
Nope. But had a hook, I could tell, on the first play. So sounded catchy. He did an up-tempo song called One Last Song. That was pretty good. That was catchy.
That's interesting. Like, so when you say up-tempo, because obviously he's had the song with Disclosure, and are they in that kind of mold, or do you think it's something a little...
It's sort of like I Can, a single from the first album.
Okay.
So, you know, mid-tempo, up-tempo. I mean, compared to some of the ballads that are so slow for Sam, anything with tempo is going to sound pretty up-tempo.
Right.
But it did. A ballad called Burning, and then Too Good at Goodbyes he did at the end. And again, people were singing along to that as well. People seem to know the song already. Whole sing-along for Stay With Me, some of the hits. People knew these songs so well, so it was just, it really felt like you just really got that sense that he was so happy that people, these songs still meant so much to everyone, even, you know, 3 years after the album release. Did a cover of Alicia Keys' Try Sleeping With a Broken Heart, which was really good.
Really?
Yeah, it really
interesting
worked. Yeah.
Choice. Stick to the original kind of arrangement and
yeah, he did, but it, sort of thinking at first, why is he doing that? And then like the clue is right in the lyric, a broken heart. That's Sam Smith lyrical territory. So he said that he needed time away to spend time with his family, just to kind of get out of the craziness that he found himself in the spotlight, but also to get new stories of heartbreak. So he said, you won't be disappointed. His love life is still going badly. So he'll still have plenty of new stories for us. So he was joking about that. So yeah, it was a really good show, and that's what the voice sounds like. If they're putting any effect on it, you couldn't tell from that show. He hits those high notes. It's just amazing.
As always seems to be the case when you have that huge first album, there's always the dreaded, you know, sophomore jinx that people will talk about around the corner. Sam Smith coming up on his sophomore album. I think we should try and dive into, you know, what do we think about Sam's chances of avoiding the sophomore jinx? Obviously off to a strong start,
right,
with the number five debut. But what kind of legs do we think that the album may have?
Well, we figure one way to look at it is to look at what he did on the first album and compare that to other acts. So he had three top tens from his debut album. Stay With Me hit number two, I'm the Only One number five, and Lay Me Down, we just mentioned, number eight. So what we're looking at, who else has notched three top tens from a debut album? Well, let's keep it to this decade, sort of comparable. So we looked at how they did first time out, and then on their follow-ups, again, one case doesn't necessarily mean it'll predict what Sam Smith will do, but just give experience for other artists. So Sam Smith is one of five artists this decade to have at least three Hot 100 top tens from a debut album. So I figure let's look at the other four and see how they've done since. First artist to do that this decade was Kesha, first album in 2010. Actually had four top tens. TikTok was the first single, number one for 9 weeks. And then as she came back, I guess maybe not fully with her second studio album. So we say project for Kesha's second?
Yeah, project should be maybe a little asterisk with this special case because you know this album project series event came out later in 2010. It wouldn't be her actual like full length follow up would be a couple years later, but I mean it's still new Kesha music. It still had a different. It wasn't something you could get on the debut album, so I think we're okay with this one.
All right, and she did well with it. So a number one hit for "We Are Who We Are," and then a top ten with "Blow" as well. And if you do go to 2012 for her official second album, "Die Young" was a number two hit. So not really a sophomore jinx. Didn't have four top tens like the first album, but continued to be a presence in the top ten. And here we are now in 2017. She's in the top 40 with "Praying." All right, next artist in the 2000s to have at least three top tens from a debut album on the Hot 100, Bruno Mars. He had three. So he actually had a number one hit, "Nothing on You," and then "Billionaire" before he even had his own songs as a lead artist. But then once he came out with his own stuff, "Just the Way You Are," number one, "Grenade," number one, "Lazy Song," number four. So three top tens for Bruno. He came back really almost identically with his second album in 2012. Two more number ones, "Locked Out of Heaven" and "When I Was Your Man," and another top five, got to number five, "Treasure." Meghan Trainor, the fourth act of the 2010s with three top tens on the Hot 100 from her debut album, "All About That Bass," number one, "Lips and Ruben," number four, and then "Like I'm Gonna Lose You" with John Legend, number eight. So Megan, same thing. She came back, hit the top 10 from her second album. Lead single, "No," got to number three. And the fifth act, sort of, we can't quite tell yet because there hasn't been the next album yet. But the other
one. I would love, I mean, because, you know, Kesha and Bruno, right. Megan, you know, pretty safe bets if you had to think about, you know, who would be in this camp of artists with these three top tens from this debut album. I do not think a lot of people are going to remember this one just because it was one of those instances where it was like so hot for a moment. And then it kind of just, you know, we haven't seen much of this guy since. So in any case, it is
Fetty Wap a couple years later.
Yes, Fetty. Ruled the summer 2015 out of nowhere.
So Trap Queen hit number two on the Hot 100. And he had two other top tens, My Way and 679. So we just haven't gotten new music yet. So far, you look at everyone on this list up to Fetty Wap, Kesha, Bruno Mars, Meghan Trainor, and Sam Smith. They've all followed up debut albums with three top tens at least on the Hot 100 with new top 10 hits from their second album. So Sam continues that, and if Fetty Wap can do that too, all five of them will have done that, at least by that measure. No sophomore jinx for any of those artists.
Yeah, they picked up right where they left off. And it'll be interesting to see again with Sam. One thing I know that probably people will be wondering if this will be the album that gets him a number one hit. You know, he's had number two with Stay With Me. Obviously a lot more, you know, attention, momentum behind him this time. So that certainly seems like something that I think his fans, most certainly, and probably the label would like to make a push for with this next album.
Oh, there's one other thing from the show I saw last week that I have to mention. Sam Smith did this thing that it's sort of always my favorite part of a concert. Always gets to me when this happens. When an artist tells a story very slowly and dramatically over music, over an intro of a song. And they're doing the intro.
And they bust out some big ballad.
It's so cheesy, but they're doing the story, and it just when they do, they could be saying anything, and it sounds like the most important dramatic thing anyone has ever said. If you just put that slow music bed underneath it, it's just everyone is totally mesmerized by what they're saying.
Yeah, it's like it's almost like those viral clips now where like people underscore dramatic moments, usually playing "My Heart Will Go On." And the big, you know, the major chorus that Celine sings at the end.
Right.
And it, you know, whether it's, you know, like the end of a basketball game or, you know, animals reuniting with their owners or whatever. It just like, you know, underscores like that moment makes it that much, gives it that much more weight to it.
I've never heard it not work. Let's try it now, Trevor. Say the most basic thing. We'll put some music under it. Let's see how dramatic it sounds.
I got to get a topic.
There's a water bottle in front of you. Do something dramatic about a water bottle.
There's a water bottle. Oh, gosh. This is tough.
All right, here's the music.
So I was at the park the other day, and I had an empty water bottle, and I went to fill it up, and they had this sign that said filtered water. So there I was, I stuck the water bottle under the filter, got the water, drank it. It made my stomach hurt pretty badly, like instantly. And had to pour it out.
I'm beginning to think they give artists training on how to do this. Maybe it's not as easy
as it looks. Oh, God. You know, it was a bad topic. We'll go with that. It was a poor water bottle, Gary. Give me something. Give some more real.
I've never heard an artist blame the audience request when the performance goes bad.
Yeah, I'm sure that. Yeah, well, I'm sure they don't request something I know. Yeah.
Some mamas and daddies are living in a straight line. Take forever to hearten and take a long sweet ride. But some mamas and daddies let their heartstrings tear and tangle. And some of us get stuck in a love triangle.
All right, moving on here on the Billboard Chartbeat podcast. That's a clip of Ray Lynn and Love Triangle, a recent top 40 hit on the Billboard Hot Country Songs chart for Ray Lynn from her number one album on the Billboard Top Country Albums chart. So she's our special guest this week here, our industry insider interview on the Billboard Chartbeat podcast, along with the CEO of Warner Music Nashville, John Esposito. So sat down recently, chatted with Billboard's senior chart manager, Jim Asker, about a lot of different things. The start of her career, she was on The Voice, how she transitioned over to Warner Brothers, how she was a writer at first, and then you'll hear, really had a vision for her own album, and a long time in the making, but really well worth it, hitting number one. And again, we mentioned earlier, talking about the topic of women at country, how it's very male-dominated in recent years. So John and Ray Lynn both talk about that and a lot more coming up here. So Jim Asker with Ray Lynn and John Esposito on the Billboard Chartbeat podcast.
Really thankful that you guys are here today.
Thank you for having us. Yeah,
first of all, to get you both in the same room.
Hey, it's fun.
It took a second.
She's touring enough and busy with other things she's doing. I don't get to see her enough. It's a lot of texting relationship.
Yes.
It's always fun when I get to hang with Ray.
And I'd like to just go back to the beginning for a second and how this relationship started. I know, Raylan, that you were on another label after The Voice.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
And so, and you sang on a Blake Shelton song.
Mm-hmm. Always had a pretty good relationship, a great relationship with Warner. I've was on The Voice, you know, when I was 17. But before The Voice, the very first place that I wrote at was Warner Chapel. And I've always been in and out of the Warner building for different reasons. And, of course, being, like, Blake's family, knowing him, I've been around Espo and Scott and Chris Lacey and a lot of the amazing people at Warner. So it was just when I was switching labels, it was definitely one of the places that I knew I had to take a meeting because I just love everybody there.
Oh, It's really nice.
Yeah.
So, but when you did the background vocals on the Blake Shelton song "Boys Round Here," is that how you guys started working together? Or it just happened before that, and
well, it. I guess you could say that we worked together.
Yes,
right?
On that.
But we've been hanging out backstage at The Voice
since I was 17.
Since you were 17, so we knew Ray well before that song was recorded, you know, from the label side, and
through Blake. I mean, I know Blake through playing things, and
it was really Blake's idea that when he was doing the cool vocals on that he had to have Ray on that, and we were celebrating that. We thought it was fantastic.
For the listeners who don't know, can you give us a quick little snapshot of how you got here to Warner Music Nashville and steering this ship really quick, just so everybody knows?
Yeah, and I'd rather hear Ray talk, but I'll tell you that, you know, I've never met a microphone I didn't like. I've been with Warner Music Group for 15 years, officially 15 years in about 2 weeks.
That's amazing.
And I started off as the president of their distribution company, WEA, which I did for about 7 years before they asked me to move to Nashville. But before that, I helped put together Island Mercury and Def Jam Records to create the Island Def Jam Music Group label group. And that's where I got my taste of label life. And as part of it, we were promoting Shania Twain Records. We were the crossover promotion team for any of Luke Lewis's stuff. So I found every excuse to come to Nashville I could, and then I made it crystal clear.
Yeah, and
I love this town.
For anybody who doesn't know, Luke was president at Mercury at the time.
Yeah, yeah.
And so much success here that Blake Shelton, Hunter Hayes, Brett Eldridge has just got a fantastic new album
so,
out.
Yeah, so awesome.
And how is your what is your day-to-day work relationship like, the two of you, Ray Lynn?
Well, I think one of the most amazing things about Warner is the family vibe of this label, and there's nobody is untouchable at this label, and I think that that's what makes Warner so special, is everybody gets on board when you get excited about something. And I've always been more of a unique artist, and I've always written a certain way, and it's a little different, it's a little left of center, and it's amazing to be in a creative space that lets me do what I do, and they champion it.
Your debut Warner album, Wild Horse, how did that come together? Did you guys talk about it from the beginning stages? And a lot of people don't know. I mean, you have this great album that debuts at number one on the charts, but how much time goes into working on that record?
I spent 5 years on my first record, and I knew exactly what I wanted on this record. And the cool thing is, when I came into Warner, I had most of it done. I had half of the record done. And I basically said, here's the vision. What do you think about it? And they were all about it. And it was pretty amazing, because there was no selling of, please, you know, figure this out, or is this right? They knew that it was right, and they just went with it because they knew it was me.
I was at the little showcase downtown when you – was that a reenactment of the signing you did, or –
yeah, I
remember?
I actually really did sign it there.
Did you?
Yes.
Was that the actual signing? Yeah. Espo, you just seemed so happy that night.
Well, I was insanely happy. You know, we loved Ray from a distance, but, you know, we don't poach artists, you know. Mm-hmm. And when the word got to us that she was available, we were thrilled that she wanted to take a meeting with us, and we were, you know, excited that the conversations were going really well. And I have a motto for our label, which is A&R runs the company, right? My job is to help create the family atmosphere, which I'm really proud of. I love the culture that we have there. But it all starts, my A&R team has to be hook, line, and sinker in. They have to be unequivocal. They love the artist, and they love the body of work. And Scott Hendricks, in this case, because this was his project to bring to me, this artist to bring to me, and he was not just raising his hands, and anybody who knows Scott knows the Oki is not the most excitable boy. You know, he's amazing, but it's not like I'm the cheerleader. I've got the pom-pom. Mm-hmm. He walks out and goes, this is really good. Yeah. When you get that from him, cool. Let's talk about it some more. So there was such passion from Scott we center around the building, which is what we do. Look, we are interested in signing this lovely artist. And everybody knew her anyhow because she was a known quantity in town, right? And then everybody starts getting their pom-poms out. And it's like, okay, now we have to have this artist. So the enthusiasm you felt that night at the signing party was genuine real. From the whole crew. And we knew that she already had the record, right? I mean, the album. You know, we knew that we had several single choices.
Yeah, right? When you introduced it that night, you said this is a life-changing record. Just the lyrics that just affect anybody in your own life and make you think about your own. That's a testament of a great writer, I think, that you write this story and that everybody can relate to it.
And I think what makes Love Triangle so special is it was one of those records. I wrote it when I was 18 years old, five years ago. And that song opened up so many doors for me in this town. I remember right after I wrote that song, I was able to write with Natalie Hemby and Shane McAnally and Brad Tersey and Sarah Buxton, like some of the greatest writers in Nashville, because they heard this record. And it just opened so many doors for me, and it became kind of I call it a Music Row favorite. And it was, and everybody would always ask me, why don't you put out Love Triangle? Why don't you put out Love Triangle? And it just never happened. So to be able to be at Warner and them want to champion this song to be the first single and take a risk on it, I was like, heck yeah, let's do it. And it's really cool to see what it did.
So was it an automatic pick? Everybody was just like, let's go with it. No second, you know, at that point.
Unequivocal, you know. And I'm very proud of what that song did. It helped be the catalyst to deliver a number one record, let's be clear. And it has some extraordinary stats in terms of that song. This may be boring to the listeners a little bit, but we judge ourselves by chart position for sure. But one of the things that really matters is consumption, they call it.
Yeah.
And consumption is how many streams, how many sales do you have, how many YouTube views or Vivo views. And when you put them all together, that song was consistently, from the outset, the entire time we worked at a top 10, consumption, beating records that made it to number one. And it was many weeks a number five or higher consumption. And, you know, that can be the frustrating thing, because the most frustrating word from radio people is room, right? But I'm proud of it. And I'm proud to watch how people react at every show that Ray plays that song, and it still lives on in the streaming world.
I think that song will just far outlive its chart position. And our Hot Country Songs chart at Billboard is our consumption chart of streaming sales and airplay. And it's just about how it's changing every day and how people are consuming music. Radio is, of course, still very, very important. I want to know for a second, though, when that album debuted at number one on our top country album chart, what was that like after working on it for so long?
For me, I just couldn't believe that it was real, and it was like seeing all my hard work pay off. I mean, I spent 5 years perfecting this record and praying that every fan that I met after a show. So after every show, I go out to my merch booth and I'll meet every fan. If it takes me an hour, it takes me an hour. If it takes me 2 hours, it takes me 2 hours. But every fan will come up to you and they're like, when's your record coming out? I'm going to get it. I mean, I promise I am. And you pray all those little seeds that you plant will grow into something amazing. And so throughout all of those years of being on the road, 5 years, I was just hoping when my record came out that they were really going to do what they said and get this music that I've spent so much time on. And they showed up. I mean, I just can't even. God Made Girls is my first single, but it wasn't on my record. And it wasn't, you know, a top 15 hit. And then, you know, I had For a Boy, and that song did okay, but it wasn't on the record. So this record was brand spanking new, all new music. And so that was a little nerve-wracking to put out. But the fans showed up, and they absorbed every lyric, and they were there for me. And to see that was amazing, and to also see have that success at such an amazing place like Warner and have them jump on board so fast and not make me wait to put out the music, and they were just so excited about it. To be able to celebrate it together, I know, was just awesome. Like, it just was a full circle
so
moment
great.
For me.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
What was it like for you, Espo?
Well, we of course celebrate any number one record, but a huge part of what I guess, you know, the emotional part of it was I knew she had waited 5 years to have people hear a body of work, and I definitely wanted us to be the label that made the statement that here's a body of work. You know, the paradigm of the record business has been for years, you release a song to terrestrial radio. You hope it works well enough that it gives you a justification to put an album out. You know, if it doesn't get to number one, you release another song. And the fans have heard two songs, right? I mean, this has been years. The wonderful new world we're in is we can expose more music. And, you know, just when I rattled off some of those consumption numbers, it told us that fans wanted to know her more. And it wasn't fair to fans to have it be, okay, it's only the first two singles she mentioned from her prior label and Love Triangle. It was time for them to hear more music and get to know her. That's the artist development process. That's what we live for, mm-hmm. right? And we know we have a very long road ahead and a very great road ahead with Ray, but we have to start somewhere, and that's by giving them that. The fact that they came out and said it's worth buying to make it a number right. one record was only more gratifying.
What I love about it, I didn't mean to cut you off.
Oh,
what I love about it is that I'm a fan of albums, having grown up with, you know, the great albums of our era. It's a cohesive album, and I really love that. And you wrote 11 of the 12 songs. True artistry. So congratulations on it landing at number one. It was
Thank
the
you.
First solo female number one since Hero by Maren Morris. It's a long time in between females. So I think the more women that are out there with successful music, the better it is for everyone.
You know? Well, I agree with you 100%. And that was my goal with this record. I just wanted it to be a body of work from right when you started, the very first song, Your Heart, to Praying for Rain. I wanted you to go on a journey with me and see where my heart's been in the last 5 years. And I feel like you can see that and you can feel that. And it's awesome because, like, I haven't really listened to my record a lot in the last month, I guess you could say, but I was in the car and I was doing a little road trip and I just listened to it from the front to back again. And I was just so impressed with it. That's what I wanted. I wanted everything to be super, super strategic on how we placed it. And I'm so proud that it's my debut record. Mm.
And I want to make a comment on your comment, Jim, that she wrote all but one of the songs. Ray is an amazing writer. There is no ifs, ands, or buts. Mm-hmm. The stuff people haven't heard is exciting. What's ahead? But I think one of the greatest signs for an artist who gets it but also wants it is to say, and look, I found this song and I have nothing to do with it, but I want to record this, because some can't let their ego get in the way, right? And you know, it was a proud moment in the building when she shared that. I mean, she's an emailer of songs. Hey, guys, what do you think? And I heard the apple and I said, wow, when did you write that? Oh, I had nothing to do with it.
But it's mine.
But it's mine. That's really fun for people in our position. Because then you know she wants to win by giving them the best thing that tells her story. And sometimes, I mean, look at Blake Shelton. I think maybe over the course of 11 records, he's written maybe 3 songs. I don't think any of them were singles, to be clear. You know, the best song should win. She just happens to be able to write amazingly well.
And Love Triangle, you know, like I said, it's going to outlive its chart position. I wasn't at the Little Big Town show when you went on stage with
yes.
them, but a good friend of mine texted me really early the next morning and just started blasting me about repeating what she said and agreeing with it, who is also an ex-radio person. And can you just tell us about that moment? It had to be, like, vindication a little bit for you?
It was. I first of all, adore Karen and Kimberly and just everybody in Little Big Town. They're just all such incredible people.
So they're playing the Ryman. You come up on stage.
Yes. I opened up for them. If whoever doesn't know, I opened up for them at their Ryman residency. And it was funny because during my set, I didn't sing Love Triangle. And you could tell the fans were kind of surprised. They're like, why the heck isn't she singing Love Triangle? And then I came back out and did it with Little Big Town. And after I sang it, Karen basically was talking about radio and how the song didn't go number one, but it should have. And of course it was like, it was just, I didn't ask her to say anything. I didn't even know that she would. And I was just like, well, go get him, Karen. Like, it was just, I mean, she's an amazing, amazing person. And I thought that was really sweet.
And what did she say?
She basically just said that there's no denying that it's hard for females out there. And listen to all of you guys singing the song, and this song, you know, should have went number one. And that's basically what she said.
I wrote a story for Billboard just recently, surrounded around the Billboard power issue, which I suppose one of our super duper power players. And
super duper, holy cow! I got an upgrade.
And anyway, they wanted me to write a rundown of how we did with women a year later after the Tomato Gate. And all of that chatter, somebody comparing female artists to tomatoes on sale. And I love tomatoes. And
you're very good.
And it all started after that. And how did we do? And it was a little better from year to date, but not much. And as I looked at the chart when I interviewed Maren a little while ago, there were three women in the top 30 of the Airplay chart. When I came in this morning with you guys, there were two in the top 30. Two solo females out of 30 songs. What does it say to you, both of you? Just honest opinions.
My honest opinion is you can talk about change all the time, but unless you do something, it's just talk. And I think that there's got to be a change because women are putting out incredible music right now. And the streaming shows it. I mean, my new song, my new song, Lonely Call, you know, hasn't charted yet, but it has almost 5 million streams. Like, it's just, it's crazy to me. But I'm not the only one. So many females are having this problem, and it's just something still to talk about. I mean, that's, when I see that, it just makes me sad because it's ridiculous, in my opinion.
Espo?
Well, I don't think I could say it any better than that, honestly. You know, and I'm not worried about walking on any eggshells. You know, part of the problem, from my estimation, is you have consolidation at radio that continues to make programmers looking over their shoulders, a vast yes. majority of them. So they go to the safe because, you know, sadly, a lot of them, the music business in my now nearly three decades of the music business, I've watched tens of thousands of people get fired from record labels because of the decimation of record stores and you know, Napster starting a thing that I don't want to get philosophical about all of that, but it is a reality. And I'm watching the same thing that has happened in radio. And so what ends up happening is established superstars today happen to be a bunch of guys, and they get a green card every time they put a new song out. Thank mm-hmm. God Blake does and Brett does and Cole in our yeah. case, right? But all of a sudden, a massive chunk of the spins that are available are eaten up by the top 15 that are the same safe bets. A lot of great music from the safe bets. It's hard for any new artist to break in.
I know.
And it just it causes a problem. I don't think that people are consciously, not all of them, not many of them, consciously saying, well, it's a female, my audience doesn't want to hear females. I think it's tough for any artist. And unfortunately, that has created a real tough space for the development of female in particular.
I agree with you on
that. You know, when Carrie comes back, she's going to get the same green card when she puts her new record out. You know, and Miranda will continue to get it. So there'll be more than two or three. I don't know when the cycle gets broken in terms of people. I know one of the things you wanted to talk about eventually, and I we'll tee it up, but I can talk about it more in depth lately. But streaming has changed the world. It's the first time the music business has grown in 15 years.
Well, you know, we talked about Little Big Town, their song Girl Crush on our Hot Country Songs chart, the consumption chart of the combination mm-hmm. of streaming sales and airplay, was number one for a group of three people or more. It was the first 10-week number one since the Browns, Three Bells.
How about it?
So it never made it to number one on our airplay chart.
And we want terrestrial radio. We want it. That's the when you got the bad mamma jamma, you got both happening. But people are going to start going...
Bad Bamba Jamma.
Bad Bamba, and it's my Island Def Jam days probably coming up.
And a long time ago, when you would go on radio tour, a lot of... I mean, I still have so many amazing people that wave the Raylan flag at radio. Like, I've met so many... I've done three radio tours.
There are a lot of programmers who believed in it and supported it.
And they do, but I think I agree with Espo. They have a lot of people. I mean, they have bosses. They have people that they have to please too. And I think it's a hard place to be in, to be able to want to pour into a new artist, but also make your listeners happy. And I mean, I honestly, my heart goes out to them because I know that it's hard.
Here's the thing. It's not a new thought. I started programming radio, which I did before. I was a programmer for a long time, and my first gig was when I was like 24 years old. Mm-hmm. And I remember a consultant say, you don't play two female songs back to back. You don't have two female announcers back to back, because women don't like listening to women. And we'd be like, who says that? Listeners don't ever say anything like that. So it's been going on but we were rebellious back then, and you could only own 12 radio stations.
Yeah.
So we knew if we got, you know, if I was telling Carrie, your manager, as a PD, I was always like, if I'm going down with the ship, I'm going to make the decision. So,
yeah, of course.
And now there's just so many people.
And it's funny that they say that about women. Women don't want to hear other women. I'm sorry. At my show at the Mercy Lounge in Nashville that was sold out, 80% of the people at my concert were women. So I would have to really disagree with that. Of course, my fan base is very, there's a lot of variety. It's very different, but most of them are women and young girls.
You're all alone and you're thinking about me.
Your new song, Lonely Call. It's a great song.
Thank you. Thank you.
You wrote that as well?
Yes, I wrote Lonely Call. I wrote it when I was 18. It's always been one of Blake's favorites.
You wrote that one when you were 18, too?
18 or 19. I can't remember. I was a teenager.
Wow.
I'm 23. So I think I was 18 or 19.
And for anybody who hasn't heard the song, tell us about it.
So I wrote that. I moved to Nashville when I was right after The Voice, and me and my husband were dating for about 8 months.
Is he an artist?
No, he's not. He's in the Army. He's totally different job than me. But we dated for about 8 months, and then we broke up for 2 years, and we got back together. Long story short, in that time that we were broken up, I mean, anybody can say that when you first break up with somebody, it's hard because they're the first person that you text when you wake up. They're the first person that you text when you go to bed or call. And so we were each other's lonely call, and I was just like, hey, if we're going to break this off, we've got to cut this, you know, cold turkey. We can't talk. I can't do this anymore. Like, I'm not going to be your lonely call. You can't be my lonely call. So I actually wrote it about my husband. But clearly it worked out, which is awesome.
And it's starting out great, isn't it, Espo?
Yeah, it is. We have, we've got a lot of fans. We, you know, there was a day... I feel like I'm doing my music education program or my radio programming education, but there was a day when records would chart after 2 or 3 weeks, you know, and some 4 or 5. It's really harder, especially for still developing artists, for that to happen. But like Ray said, we're actually over 5 million streams on this record. We're getting a reaction that, you know, tells us keep the fight, you know, and
it had a big week at radio, by the way. I do the airplay chart, and it was right underneath the chart with a huge percentage up from
100%,
last week.
Yep. So I didn't mean the
percentage. What we call new and active.
That was something one of my old bosses was like a validation exclamation point. 100%. not the percentage that it was up. But yeah. And it's a brilliant song. I'll tell you a funny story about it.
Now, who picked this one as a single? Real
well, you know, there you go. But I think Blake Shelton had something to do with
it, too. The fans of Blake Shelton. Blake is a fan, so that counts.
Blake is a fan. I get a text from Blake out of the blue, I guess, whatever, 3 months ago, and he goes, don't tell me you're going to screw it up and not pick Lonely Call. Something to that effect, right?
When you're Blake, you can say that, right?
And but he and I mean, if you read some of our texts, they were definitely make his tweets seem like they were tame, right? But I said, hey, listen, it's on the short list. He goes, okay, cool. You guys don't screw it up. And he may not have used the word screw when he said that. And so I came back to Scott Hendricks and I said, well, I love it. And Scott goes, I love it. The artist always wins, just so you're clear. The process is usually we've narrowed it down to two or three.
Well, and it's funny because I got a random text from Scott. He goes, hey, can I jump on the phone with you for a second? And I said, cool. And he calls me. He's like, what do you think about Lonely Call being the next single? And I said, done. Like, and I said, and I was like, is this going to be our system? Because I love it. Are we going to agree this well? Agree to disagree? Like, it honestly just worked. And I remember doing like a little poll on my Instagram and I said, hey, what song do you want to be the next single? We did a little chart. Lonely Call was like way out past anything else.
Yeah.
And being on the road too, I just did my first headlining tour this year called the Rave Tour. And they sing Lonely Call just as loud as they sing Love Triangle, just as louder than they sing God Made Girls. It is by far a fan favorite.
That's great. Are you visiting radio stations right now?
Oh, of course. I've built so many incredible relationships with radio. I've known them. They've got to watch me grow up. I have started this whole journey since I was 18 years old. And so I love to do, I just got done with a radio show yesterday in Orlando. And any way that I can get involved, I love to. I mean, I think that's why it is hard to some extent because I am so accessible to them and I am always wanting to do things for radio.
And I know the label's on a mission. I talked to Kristen, your head of promotion, Kristen Williams, before I started the interview, and I know she's really high on it.
She's amazing.
And by the way, you were the first label to add streaming onto their titles. This is the first time I've seen you to talk to you since then. So how did that come about, and what does that mean, basically? So are they calling, on top of calling radio, that they call Spotify? And
it might have started on a beach in Nantucket. With a beer in my hand, and I had an epiphany, and that was that the world of streaming was coming on resoundingly, and we have at the average record label probably 50% of our overhead has gone to the staff that goes to radio, mm-hmm. terrestrial radio,
right.
And streaming has come on so quickly, we only had a few people who were involved in it. And I said, I've got these people whose job every day of the week it is to go and convince radio programmers to add something to their playlist. Why would I not tap into those resources and therefore expand our team? Full commitment still to the terrestrial radio team, but expand the size of what was our approach to the streaming companies with some more people from that. Mm-hmm. And I will tell you that unequivocally it's been a win for us. And it has benefited in so many ways because the exchange of information that now flows from streaming stats to arm our regionals at radio with data that is compelling and understandable so that we can have a better shot at getting space on the terrestrial radio. It's gone back and for both. And it has excited the radio team because they see that that's a massive future and that they want to be part of the new world. So, here we are a year and it'll be a year next month into it. And I'm really proud that we did it and it is working.
That's awesome. I wanted to ask a personal question before we wrap up. I know that in my personal life, I'm a cancer survivor, and I'm proud of that. And Espo knows because he gives me donations every time I run a marathon. And it's part of my life and how I can help other people with it. And you deal with diabetes, and you share that personally. What is that like? What kind of challenges does it make for you when you're on the road, especially? And then it must be great to be able to help other people that come up to you and talk to you about it.
It's been really cool to be more involved in the diabetes community, especially in the last 5 years. And it's funny because it's like you said, like when you deal with it, it's just a part of your life. Like diabetes is a part of my life. It's been a part of my life since I was 12. And I don't really talk about it because it's just something I deal with every day. But a couple years ago, I was pulling out my stuff to take a shot before I ate, to take, you know, my insulin. And a fan came up to me and they were like, "I didn't know you had type 1 diabetes." And she was like, "Oh my gosh, you're even more my idol." And something about that was just like, why don't I talk about this? Like, this is something that I deal with every day. And so many fans can, because I remember when I first found out I had type 1 diabetes, I thought that my world was over. And I was like, how am I going to do this? How am I going to do that? Like, is it going to be weird when I go on a date and I have to take an insulin shot in front of a guy? Like, it was just, I had all these like insecurities, but I overcame them because I found, you know, what I wanted to do, and I wasn't going to let diabetes stop me. So it's funny because when she came up to me, that little girl, it just completely changed my mindset on just talking about it more and being more active about how I, you know, I'm always just talking about me being involved with it. And so since then, I'm now an ambassador for Novo Nordisk, the insulin that I take. But it has its ups and its downs. It's like some days I wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning to catch a 5 a.m. flight, and some days I get to sleep until 11 o'clock in the afternoon. But I think it's about, the main thing with diabetes is keeping everybody around you aware of what your sugar levels are. And I have to have a really balanced diet with protein, and can have a lot of carbs, can have a lot of sugar. And so in some places, when all you have is a McDonald's and a Walmart to eat, that can be hard, but you just have to figure it out. But that's all about having the right people around you, and having, like, my tour manager knows what kind of things I want to eat and what kind of things to look for. So she'll look prior to, if I'm going to a city and there might not be great food options, she's like, how about you pack some snacks for this trip just in case you don't find something that you can eat? But it's been a pretty amazing thing in the last couple of years to meet fans of mine that have type 1 diabetes, and I'm signing their insulin pumps, and I'm able to be a voice for them because I know how it feels when you first get diagnosed and how scary it can be.
And even for the people that you don't meet who watch you go through it, I think you motivate them and inspire them. And I just commend you for talking about
you.
It.
Thank you.
Because people do get lost in their own little world, and they don't have anybody to talk
and
to.
And they don't mean to. It's not like I didn't want to talk about the fact that I had diabetes or I was ashamed of it. It's just something that I have, you know? And so.
Well, you look great, by the way.
Thank you. Thank you. You're so sweet.
really quick, before we go, last great song you listened to, Espo, that people would be surprised about. I'm going to ask each of you.
Oh, boy. People would be surprised about?
Yeah. Something that would say, oh, wow.
Okay. Lindsey Buckingham with Christine McVie. How about that? I'll go for the old fart version, right? They have a duet album that has Mick Fleetwood and John McVie on drums, so it's effectively Fleetwood Mac, and it sounds like a throwback to 1980.
How about you?
I would say the last song that really affected me, I mean, he's in our format. I love this song. Is Grave by Thomas Rhett.
It's a great song.
It's an amazing song, and my husband's in the Army, you know, and I hadn't seen him in 20 days. He was doing a training thing, and I hadn't talked to him in forever. And so when I heard that song, I just started crying on the treadmill because I just missed him so much. And I think it's such a beautiful love song. And so I would say that's the last song that really just hit me. I was like, dang.
Dream duet partner alive or gone?
Oh, Dolly Parton for sure. So easy to answer. She's like my fairy godmother. I love her.
I'll tell you the song that I've heard a million times that's surprising that I haven't killed anybody that plays it for me is Despacito, because everybody thinks it sounds like my name, so I'm hearing Despacito.
I always start making it my own. I go, I really, really want a burrito.
Is that?
And some Doritos.
It's ubiquitous, that's for sure.
It's so funny because, like, I was talking about my husband. He's been in a training, and you know it's bad when he didn't even know that song when I saw him. I was like, have you heard this song? He goes, no. I go, oh, my gosh, you've got to get on the times.
This has been a lot of fun. I really appreciate you both being here.
Thank you for having me.
John Esposito, CEO, Chairman of Warner Music Nashville, and the awesome Ray Lynn. Good luck to both of you in everything, and thank you so much. And good luck with the new single. I hope it's number one smash.
Thank you.
And thank you. Thanks. Ray's special to us. We appreciate this time.
Once again, Ray Lynn, the song God Made Girls, which was a top 10 hit on the Hot Country Songs chart here. Our thanks to her and John Esposito and, of course, Jim Asker as well for taking the time to speak with us. Now, our flashback portion, which I guess kind of oddly enough, our flashback is really based on really, really current events. So we're going to kind of flashback a couple of days, and kind of weird because we're taping this on Tuesday. So hopefully, I guess in a way, hopefully this isn't still in the news on Thursday, but...
Kind of hope it isn't, but we think it might
be. Yeah, but if, I mean, the journalist in me kind of needs it to be, but the human in me kind of hopes it's not. Okay, we'll stop giving some mixed signals here, but we're talking about the one and only President Donald Trump this week, talking about Kim Jong-un of North Korea and calling him, quote-unquote, Rocket Man. That's his nickname for him. So, of course, that has sparked many discussions on social media and a lot of people tagging our friend Elton John, who, of course, has a huge hit single by that name. So we thought, given the sudden boost in Rocket Man's popularity this week, a great time to revisit one of Elton's classic hits on the Hot 100. So, Rocket Man, a song from 1972, eventually hitting number 6 on the Hot 100. And one thing I thought was kind of funny, just in terms of a chart perspective, it's kind of funny how song trajectories happened back then. I mean, the song's only on the chart for 15 weeks, and 4 weeks after it hits number 6, it's gone.
Right.
I mean, that's just how quickly the chart kind of turned over back in the day. So once you were a hit, you know, you got out of the way for the next one.
And Elton had so many singles, just one after another, that he would be moving on to the next one anyway. And by the time he was done with one, he had another hit. So that pattern just kept repeating.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking, I mean, from 1970 all the way till, I guess, kind of fittingly, 1999, the end of the century, into that era. And I mean, through all the things that have happened, you when you think about music history in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s, from whether it's singer-songwriters to Michael Jackson and Madonna and, you know, Mariah Carey, Boyz II Men, Whitney, whatever, Elton John is riding that wave through all of those trends. I mean, through grunge, through disco, through... I mean, he's not, you know... He's not necessarily adapting his sound, but...
No, he never really...
But it still cuts through.
He never did, like, a disco single or any... You know, a little rockier and sometimes more the beginning of his career, but you could put a song like your song up against something like The One from 1992, and they could basically be off the same album.
But also, so Rocket Man, we'll turn our attention back to the song in the moment. You know, a fun little song. Interesting lyrics, I think, more than anything, because it's a song... written about an astronaut who's going up on this journey, but it's not really this big hero celebration. Just kind of an, you know, an everyday, this is his job. He just does what he's got to do. you know, lives life the way he's got to live it. In a weird way, kind of an everyman song based on a non everyman kind of job. Some people saying, you know, of course, written by Bernie Taupin, who co-wrote really the majority of Elton John's hits. They're one of the great lyric and music pairs in pop music history. Some people saying that it's kind of based off this David Bowie song, Space Oddity from 69, something that they've kind of refuted over the years.
Both recordings were produced by the same guy. Isn't that crazy?
Yeah, I mean, which, you know, obviously there could be some shared influences there as well. But I think a song in particular that in all of the Elton John catalog has aged particularly well. I think it's one of those songs that, you know, people still to this day love it, you know, sing it. It's a great sing-along song. Even in the 90s, one of the famous kind of live performances happened in 98 when Jim Carrey came out on stage and performed the song with Elton. And I thought that was even that clip is just still kind of funny to watch today, that even then, 25 years after the song was recorded, so well-known.
And I think one of the versions people know, too, is the William Shatner, the performance art version. It was 1978. Bernie Taupin introduced it. It was. I'm looking here at the Science Fiction Film Awards in 1978. So where he does that spoken word and kind of just
kind of like dramatic reading.
Dramatic,
of it, yeah.
Yeah, kind of like what we're talking about. With the,
that's
that. You're no William Shatner, Trevor.
Got a little more flexibility in the voice, I guess.
Family Guy did a version based on the Shatner version. So that's one of the most parodied performances at this point. But a lot of cover versions over the years. The 1991 tribute album, Two Rooms, had a really good version by Kate Bush.
Yeah.
Some people might know that version. So really just just kind of a staple of rock music at this point. I was just kind of thinking as we're talking about this, you mentioned the Bowie version. Man Was on the Moon in 1969. Then we got Space Oddity. Then we got this sort of in the mindset of the introspective singer-songwriters in the late 60s, early 70s of where man was going at this point. We started getting all these space songs.
I never thought about that. That's a good point, especially new frontiers to discover and you know, what does that mean for our humanity in a lot of ways? I guess, unfortunately, that's going to be a pretty big topic, I think, in the next couple weeks and months as we see some of these effects of geopolitics start to play out. Is where is our humanity? What's in store for us, at least?
My response to that is that Alvin and the Chipmunks covered the song as well in 1998. Let's just take it in that direction.
not quite sure what that says, but
happy thoughts.
We'll try and keep a positive outlook for it.
All right. Well, we'll find out next week. We'll probably have sales or streaming gains at least. So we'll be covering that. We'll be tracking that.
Yeah, I'll be sure to talk about where that's going. And of course, we'll keep our attention on the top of the chart to see if that race for number one does indeed heat up. Taylor holding strong right now. But as we mentioned at the top of the show, a trio of challengers coming along. And Cardi B at number two, Logic at number three. And of course, the big question will be, are Post Malone and 21 Savage ready to crash the party with Rockstar? So a lot of action looking forward to next week.
And speaking of Cardi B, John McMahon from Atlantic Records will be back on the podcast to chat about her huge rise on various pop and R&B charts. So we'll be talking about that. And John was here on the podcast back in the springtime. We're talking about Ed Sheeran and Bruno Mars. Cardi B, we didn't mention, Cardi B wasn't a thing back then. This is back in the springtime. We hadn't heard of Cardi B yet.
No.
As an artist on the charts.
I'm sure no one would have seen this angle coming from her at all. And I mean, he teased the Charlie Puth music also way back when.
Right.
And, you know, by now we see that's holding strong in the top 10 as well. So
John was busy.
Couple things.
Between podcast appearances, he doing a pretty good job.
Working some new music, yeah.
So that's coming up next week. Should we close with the Chipmunks, or you got something else?
I was gonna ask you. I said, you know, we mentioned that sort of that chart stretch that Elton had from 1970 to 1999. I was gonna ask what your favorite Elton Top 40 hit was gonna be, and I do not believe the album that is the Chipmunks cover is gonna count. I mean, any song. I mean, basically any song of Elton.
You know, this time of the year, it kind of reminds me of a hit that was it was a big hit this time of the year back in 1989. Number 13 hit, Healing Hands, really plays up his piano playing, and that's when pop songs could be so driven by up-tempo. You still hear piano ballads slower, but pretty rare nowadays to hear an up-tempo pop hit that's so piano-driven. This is a perfect example of that.
Do we have any relation to healing the world, healing, helping?
Maybe appropriate this week.
I was saying, Elton is gonna bring us back together and keep our humanity alive.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.